Capital Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sams, saluting its client Seaside Community Development Corporation for supporting arts and culture in South Walton County. I'm David Powell of Hopping Green and Sams in Tallahassee.
And from The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire someone with a disability. More information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of abilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
With the start of the new year, more provisions of Florida's new PIP law came into effect, but will it stop fraud?
It's like having money sitting up in a little bag in front of everyone, and you don't have to prove anything. All you have to do is say, I hurt.
We hear from the new members of Florida's congressional delegation and how the freshman lawmakers plan to represent the Sunshine State.
I don't have any misconceptions that I'm going to come in and change the world, sponsor legislation that will be blessed by the speaker and Democrats, etc. But what I can do is be a voice for my district.
Following the Newtown, Connecticut school shooting, some Florida schools are getting an increase in armed school resource officers. And we hear all sides of another tense debate calling for a halt to executions in the state. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. Okay, so this is our first broadcast for 2013, and with the start of this new year, a handful of new laws are coming into effect. Regan McCarthy reports the measures aim to do things like protect drivers from fraud and treat children who are exploited as sex workers like victims instead of criminals.
As the new year starts, a number of bills passed during Florida's 2012 legislative session are coming into effect. Two of those bills impact all drivers in the state. Those are the changes in Florida's Personal Injury Protection, or PIP, no-fault auto insurance, as well as a rule about drivers flashing their headlights, a once-prohibited practice. Under the new law, what's called intermittent headlight flashing is now okay. The law comes after a court ruling in which a judge threw out a ticket issued to a driver who flashed his headlights to warn other drivers about a law enforcement speed checkpoint. And now Florida Highway Patrol spokesman Lieutenant Jeff Frost says drivers can flash away.
They've added an exception or an exemption for when motorists intermittently flash their headlamps, regardless of their intent.
Other kinds of flashing lights, like strobe lights, will still be prohibited, except on emergency vehicles. And thanks to the new PIP law, some say there's a chance car insurance costs will drop. PIP provides up to $10,000 in coverage for health care and lost wages for accident victims. A few initial pieces of the bill took effect in July, but the lion's share is just coming in now and will impact the kinds of care an accident victim can receive and the time frame in which they must seek that care. The idea is that the changes will cut down on PIP fraud, a big problem in Florida, which would hopefully lead to those lower rates. But Senator David Simmons says he's not sure the new law will work the way lawmakers had hoped it would.
I'm afraid that any kind of attempts to stop fraud in a system that doesn't require fault to get money, it's like having money sitting up in a little bag in front of everyone, and you don't have to prove anything. All you have to do is say, I hurt, then get the $10,000. It's the kind of thing that causes people to commit fraud.
And Simmons, a Republican from Altamont Springs, who will head the State Banking and Insurance Committee, says once the Federal Affordable Care Act comes more fully online in 2014, he thinks the state's requirement that all drivers have PIP insurance will become duplicative.
PIP insurance doesn't pay for pain and suffering that somebody might incur in an automobile accident. It's used to pay for medical care and for lost wages. However, I think that, at least anecdotally speaking, the general consensus is that not much of that $10,000 is ever used for lost wages. It's used for medical care.
Simmons says it's an issue he expects his committee to take up in the coming session. Another measure that's taking effect this month will change the way officials deal with underage sex workers. Previously, those children were funneled through the Department of Juvenile Justice, but under the new law, they would typically be sent to welfare workers through the Department of Children and Families instead. Aaron Gillespie with DCF says that will help ensure those exploited children get the kind of care they need.
Many times children, especially teenagers, are treated as criminals when they are involved in this kind of activity, but we know that, in fact, most of them are victims. They're being used and exploited, and they really deserve the chance to receive services and treatment, counseling, and help instead of going into the delinquency system.
Florida is known as a hub for human trafficking. Another law aimed at cracking down on the crime went into effect last year. Several other laws are also taking effect throughout 2013, including a measure that creates more uniform rules for business transactions in the state. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A new Congress has been sworn in this week, and several of its newest members hail from the Sunshine State. As Sasha Cordner reports, there are 6 men and 1 woman, all hoping to make their mark on Capitol Hill in Washington to do what they say Floridians elected them to do.
Thursday afternoon marked the start of the 113th Congress, and for some of its newest members, the swearing-in ceremony had them feeling all sorts of emotions.
You know, it's very exciting, very humbling. I'm ready to get going.
For others, like Florida Congressman Ellen Grayson, they're already looking at the job ahead. Grayson joined 6 other U.S. representatives as the newest Florida members. The difference is he's not a freshman. The Democrat is a former representative who lost his re-election bid in 2010, but he came back swinging in 2012 and won. Grayson says one thing he's hoping to do is clear up the misconception that, quote, nothing can be done in Washington.
And people who say that and people who think that should not be running for Congress. The fact is that there are solutions to our problems. In many cases, they're painfully obvious. The only thing preventing them is entrenched special interests, usually entrenched special interests that support the Republican Party. But whether it's the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, the fact is we can pull together. There's no reason why we have to have 25 million people in this country who can't find full-time work. The country is what we make of it.
And that's why Republican Congressman Ted Yoho says he ran for office to bring about change. He's a veterinarian who's now serving the North Central Florida area after defeating longtime incumbent Cliff Stearns.
I've had enough. I've had enough of Washington standing in the way of job creation. And I've had enough of the career politicians who've created this mess, insisting they're the only ones who can get us out of this. As a businessman, as a large animal veterinarian, I feel I have a different perspective than the career politicians.
And he may not be the only one feeling that way. Republican Congressman Trey Radel serves the 18th Congressional District in Southwest Florida. The former reporter and current businessman called Congress in the past, quote, dysfunctional, and says it's time to work across the aisle and focus on what's really important.
I'm a freshman. I don't have any kind of misconceptions that I'm going to come in and change the world, sponsor legislation that will be blessed by the speaker and Democrats, etc. But what I can do is be a voice for my district. And like so much of the United States, it's all about the economy, jobs.
And that's a sentiment echoed by all the new Florida freshmen, including the youngest House member of Congress, Patrick Murphy, who represents the 18th district serving the South Florida area. The 29-year-old ran against GOP incumbent Alan West and defeated him last year. Murphy is now looking at ways to rejuvenate the economy, including stabilizing the housing market, especially in Florida, which he says is one reason he's been assigned to the House Financial Services Committee. The Democrat adds he's also been working across the aisle on legislation that aims to help the state's environment.
When you have discharges from the lake, when you have things like Hurricane Sandy that come through and devastate our beaches, tourism takes a big hit. And when tourism takes a hit, so does the economy. And in addition to that, so much of the real estate market in the district is based on clean water, clean air, nice beaches, et cetera. So we have to keep that in mind. But it's really it's our economy. So a dollar spent on the environment, studies have shown, brings back $4 to our economy. So it's smart spending.
Another fellow Democrat hoping to work across the aisle on several issues like jobs, the economy, transportation, and Medicare is the only woman of the new Florida bunch, Democrat Lois Frankel. She's a former mayor and state lawmaker, and she made a bit of history by becoming the first woman to represent the state's 22nd congressional district in the South Florida area.
I liken the Congress to being like a car stuck in the mud, and everybody keeps pushing in opposite directions, and they can't get the crawl out of the mud, but you have to know when to compromise, because that's the only way we're going to keep this country moving in the direction it should be moving, which is forward.
The other new Florida congressmen are Ron DeSantis, a Republican, and Joe Garcia, a Democrat. DeSantis is a former U.S. Navy JAG officer and federal prosecutor who will serve on several House panels, including the Judiciary and Foreign Affairs Committees. Like DeSantis, Garcia will also be sitting on the House Judiciary Committee. He's the first Cuban-American Democrat to represent South Florida in Congress. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, in the wake of the Newtown, Connecticut school shooting, more attention is being paid to school resource officers. But some say putting more cops in schools isn't a good idea.
I'd say back off on police presence in most places, except, you know, the most exceptionally violent schools, and not just on one unique occasion when a mentally disturbed person goes berserk.
A death row inmate is freed after a retrial, reigniting the debate over capital punishment in Florida.
Step one would be for Governor Scott to act and call a halt to executions to prevent the possible execution of other wrongfully convicted people.
And Florida's local governments worry that state government meddling could drain police and fire pension funds.
It's unsustainable at the current levels of spending and level of benefits, and we want to be able to provide the pensions that these police and firefighters have earned.
In the wake of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, many people have been questioning the safety of public schools. Suggestions for improving campus safety range from letting administrators carry weapons to putting in more police officers. But as Lynn Hatter reports, others are pointing to a program already in place in the majority of public schools across the country, school resource officers.
Days after the Newtown, Connecticut school shooting, Leon County Superintendent Jackie Pons greets students as they leave from class at Tallahassee's Sable Palm Elementary School.
With that going on, as I felt like it was real important that we got our leadership team through our district office out in all of our schools. I wanted to see my children, the children that are in our school system, so to reassure them that schools are a safe place to be.
In the wake of the shooting, districts started reviewing safety rules and procedures. Those policies were tested when, right before the winter break, a Leon High School student brought a gun on campus. Lieutenant James McQuaig is the spokesman for the Leon County Sheriff's Office.
They isolated the student. They got him out of class. He was actually in a class, removed him from the class, and were able to confirm that he was, in fact, in possession of a handgun. He had it on his body.
The student was charged with two felonies for carrying an unloaded semi-automatic handgun. The school's resource officer was the first responder to the call. And National Association of School Resource Officers President Kevin Quinn says that kind of response makes a big difference.
The fact that I'm already here on the campus, you've taken a 4 to 5 minute police response time to get to your school and deal with an issue to a matter of 2 or 3 seconds for me just to walk down the hallway.
School resource officers are sworn law enforcement agents who work in schools. Just like regular police officers, many of them carry weapons. Right now, the officers are mostly in Florida's middle and high schools. Quinn says the association supports expanding the program to elementary schools, but he adds it can only happen with the support of local communities. Shortly after the Newtown shooting, the National Rifle Association called for armed security guards in every school. But the suggestion was largely scorned by NRA critics who say the organization is being insensitive to the tragedy. But the NRA stance isn't much different from current school resource officer programs. Some, like Florida State Criminology Professor Gary Kleck, say what schools need is a lesser police presence.
If anything, I'd say back off on police presence in most places, except the most exceptionally violent schools, which are violent week after week, and not just on one unique occasion when a mentally disturbed person goes berserk.
Kleck says police officers are too expensive and divert resources from other areas of communities that may need more support. He says if someone in a school has to be armed, it should be a teacher or administrator who's been trained.
Whoever on the staff, whether it be administrator or teacher, who has some prior law enforcement or military experience, And the next best thing would be simply somebody who was, you know, willing and able to do it, to carry out the functions, physically able to do it, and who went through a thorough training program.
Clegg says shootings like those in Newtown are rare. And according to the National Center for Education Statistics, school crime rates, which peaked at about 38 per 1,000 schools in the early 90s, have fallen to just 4 per 1,000 schools. Other critics against school resource officers say they drive up the criminalization of things like bad behavior or fights that don't result in injuries. National Association of School Resource Officers President Kevin Quinn says he's aware of those concerns, but he says the program dates back to the 1950s, and the school officers are more than just armed guards patrolling the halls.
School resource officers are considered a member of the faculty. You do law-related education, teaching in the classrooms. You're also an informal counselor available for students if they're having law-related or legal issues, and that even goes all the way up to teachers.
A 2011 report crafted by researchers at the University of South Florida and Loyola University noted, quote, an indication that the presence of SROs may to some degree serve as a deterrent for serious crime. Prior to the NRA's statement on the Newtown shooting, Leon County School Superintendent Jackie Pons, along with the county sheriff, wrote a letter to Governor Rick Scott asking for additional funds for more officers. And Republican Representative Mike Fasano is also asking Scott to include extra funding in the state budget for the programs. Meanwhile, the Hillsborough County School District has announced it's voluntarily putting resource officers in its 150 elementary schools for the rest of the year. And in Alachua County, police and sheriff officials will temporarily be in all the district's public elementary schools. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
In December, a convicted murderer on death row became the 24th person in Florida to be retried and exonerated of his crimes. As Jessica Palumbo reports, his release from prison after almost 20 years has incited anti-death penalty activists to demand a halt to executions in the state.
Florida is the state with the most people who were sentenced to death but later acquitted of their crimes. The state's 24th overturned conviction came in December. Seth Penelvar was acquitted of murdering three people in Miramar after his third trial. He'd been in prison since 1994 while appealing the conviction. Cases like Penelvar's have critics calling for Florida to reevaluate capital punishment.
Step one would be for Governor Scott to act and call a halt to executions to prevent the possible execution of other wrongfully convicted people.
That's Mark Elliott. He's executive director of a coalition called Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. He says he perceives an inequity between criminals who get life in prison versus death. He says about 90% of people sentenced to death couldn't afford a lawyer when they were convicted. He also notes that in the state's history, black and white people have been sentenced to death for killing white people, but not once has a white person gotten death for killing a black person.
In the South, especially the Deep South, we have traditions. Some are wonderful traditions, and some are just old bad habits that need to change. And whether it's lynching people, hanging them, shooting them, injecting them with poison, electrocuting them.
Last year, more than a quarter of new death sentences in the U.S. came from Florida. And of the 22 in the state, about a quarter of those came from Jacksonville. Elliott says there's no state oversight over the death penalty process to ensure a statewide standard. He says the current system lets prosecutors look tough on crime.
So it's an incentive for state attorneys to get money directly from the state treasury and pursue these expensive, high-profile death cases.
With the appeals process, Elliott says death sentences end up costing the state at least 5 times more than life sentences without parole. And Democratic State Representative Michelle Raywinkle-Vasalinda from Tallahassee wants to abolish the death penalty altogether and use that money elsewhere.
More FDLE labs, more CSI, more police and law enforcement that are out on the streets. I'd like to see that money shifted, and I'd like to see our energy shifted toward the prevention of crime and the catching of criminals and putting them away.
Raywinkle-Vasalinda tried to get the death penalty abolished last session, but in her words, it went down in flames. She says she learned that lawmakers of every party are reluctant to touch capital punishment because of the perception that abolishing it makes you easy on crime. But she says study after study has shown it's not a deterrent to would-be criminals.
Look at our role as legislators and whether we are in the business of vengeance or whether we're in the business of helping to protect the citizens that we represent against dastardly criminals.
Meanwhile, Melbourne Republican Senator Thad Altman has filed a bill that would require a jury to unanimously choose the death penalty. Florida is just one of two states that allow capital punishment yet don't require a unanimous jury vote. Governor Scott, who signed three death warrants last year, has said it's his duty to uphold the law of Florida. He had this to say after signing one of them.
As governor, it's a very solemn obligation to do this, and so I spend a lot of time praying about it.
Scott's office did not respond by this story's deadline about whether he's considering halting executions. Florida currently has 407 people on death row. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tramell Gomes. Here's some other news around Florida. A state report says election staff inexperience and inadequate procedures fueled vote counting problems in one of the country's most watched congressional races. The report out today from the Department of State focuses on St. Lucie County, where Alan West and Patrick Murphy battled in the country's most expensive House race. The razor-thin contest gave way to 2 weeks of recounts, court fights, and allegations that votes weren't properly counted. As Sasha Cordner reported earlier, Murphy was ultimately declared the winner of the race, unseating West, a first-term hero of the Tea Party movement. But it came after many allegations of electoral malfeasance by supporters of West. The Department of State review found at least four incidences in which St. Lucie County voting machine memory cards failed, as well as numerous ballot scanning errors and missing logs of ballots. A state committee that reviews child deaths is asking the Florida legislature for broader review powers. For the 13th year in a row, the leading causes of preventable death among children in Florida are drowning and sleeping with babies. That's according to the 2012 annual report from the Statewide Child Abuse Death Review Committee. Chairman Terry Thomas says the committee reviewed 126 child deaths that the Department of Children and Families verifies as neglect or abuse, but he says that's not enough oversight.
And the recommendation we make every year as a priority is that our state committee review all child deaths, not just verified deaths with the Department of Children and Families.
Thomas says those make up a tiny percentage of all child deaths in the state. Cases that aren't counted under the current tracking system include drownings that aren't verified as neglect. The committee is also recommending more education for new parents on how to prevent accidental deaths. Finally, the pension issue is likely to come up again in this year's Florida lawmaking session. In the past, that discussion has mostly affected state government workers. But Tom Flanagan reports local governments expect to enter the debate this go-around.
When a think tank study is titled Trouble Ahead, it's a good bet it contains bad news. Back in September, the Leroy Collins Institute at Florida State University released its Trouble Ahead report on the pension issue. It showed that employee pensions now consume more of the state's local government budgets than previously thought. Combined with health insurance benefits for retirees, pension costs now eat up 8.1% of county spending. Florida's 50 largest cities are spending about 8.3% for the same thing. Perhaps most alarming is that pension contributions for public safety employees, such as police and fire, have nearly doubled over the past 7 years. Scott Dudley is Legislative Affairs Director for the Florida League of Cities.
It's a big worry for us in terms of the fiscal stability, not only of the cities, but a more important point is the fiscal stability of those police and firefighter pension plans. It's unsustainable at the current levels of spending and level of benefits.
This is not a new problem. Dudley says it began in 1999. That's when the Florida legislature started what he calls meddling in the pension agreements local governments negotiated with police and firefighters. One legislative mandate, he says, forces excess pension fund payments to go towards extra benefits.
And extra benefits include things like 53rd pay week, a high multiplier for their retirement plan, or just a whole host of different variables out there in terms of what the extra benefits are.
Bottom line, says Dudley, it's a big drain on the bottom line.
They're costing local governments about $500-something million since 1999, and that's taxpayer dollars, and it's hard for us to be good stewards of the taxpayers' dollars when the legislature has dictated that we have to spend money in a certain way.
And it's not only local government officials who dislike the state controls on their first responder pensions. Here's Metro Broward Professional Firefighters President John McNamara appearing before a state Senate committee a couple of years ago.
A lot of our contracts with our employers have been negotiated on the notion that we were getting those type of benefits. And in turn, we tweaked our contracts to maybe receive less pay or less insurance benefits or maybe some less lucrative vacation policies.
The state's ongoing interference, McNamara said, often trumps those local agreements. Last year, Steve Cleland with the Orlando area local of the International Association of Firefighters expressed similar frustration as he stood outside a legislative hearing room.
And what the state is trying to do is saying that we don't care what you've collectively bargained. We're going to decide what your benefit levels will be.
So once again, local government and police and fire lobbyists will be working the legislature during the 2013 session. The League of Cities' Scott Dudley is hopeful.
Senator Jeremy Ring has already indicated that he is going to be putting a bill together on the Senate side that deals with local government pensions. I know Governor Scott has been helpful with respect to the Division of Retirement Services, looking at the current law and trying to interpret it in a way that makes more sense.
Meanwhile, many of Florida's local governments will still be dealing with pension systems that are woefully underfunded. The Collins Institute Trouble Ahead study says counties are only investing about 40% of what they should in their pension funds. Cities are paying in around 30% of what they need to. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Kordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. Thanks also to public radio stations from around the state. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tramell Gomes, inviting you to join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org.
Capitol Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green & Sams, saluting its client Seaside Community Development Corporation for supporting arts and culture in South Walton County. I'm David Powell of Hopping Green & Sams in Tallahassee.
And from the Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too, on the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.